Hello, Greg. This is Dennis Stevens here. And the date is the 12th of January, 1993. And I thought I'd get round to giving a detailed reply to the tape you sent me in December about the upper level Scientology tech. Our weather here in Brisbane is typical tropical Brisbane weather. We have two types of summer weather here. Well, by the way, were you born in Brisbane? In which case, you probably know the weather here better than I do. Your mother lives here, and maybe you were born here and lived here most of your life. But as far as I'm concerned, we only have two types of summer weather here. When the monsoon trough moves down over the tropics, we get the tail end of it down here. It makes us very, very humid and very cloudy and very wet. Then once in a while, very, very hopefully, when we're very, very lucky, some cool air breaks through from the south. The wind, which has been in the northeast, which is when the tropical air is in, comes in from the northeast, from the Coral Sea. Then the wind goes round to the southeast and becomes the southeast trade wind, which is probably the real wind for this latitude in the summer. And the weather goes back to perfect, with just a little overnight rain and beautiful blue skies and big fluffy masses of cumulus during the day. Typical subtropical summer weather. But we've had a fortnight now of the monsoon trough, active monsoon trough weather, and it's very, very trying indeed, with the high humidity day and night and high temperatures. Well, it's not, the temperatures aren't high, they only get up to about 85 during the day. But unfortunately, the nights don't get much lower than 75. This is Fahrenheit, of course. And it makes sleep very, very difficult. But anyway, if you've lived up here for any length of time, you would know all about this weather in Brisbane in the summer. You may be able to faintly detect some background music. I'm playing some space music in the background. Largely because it helps my concentration when I'm recording. And also cuts down considerably on background noises from neighbours and so forth, barking dogs, yelling children, and what have you. So you may hear this background music on the tape. I don't think you'll hear any other sounds. Now, before I go any further, Greg, I ought to tell you that I've recorded this tape with a Dolby filter in place. The reason for this is that as soon as I put the tape through the machine, I realised that it had a fair bit of background noise on it. It's a speech tape. It's not a tape that's good enough quality for music, but it's a good enough quality for speech. But unfortunately, it's got a fair bit of background noise. And the Dolby filter, you're probably familiar with the principle of the Dolby filter, but the effect is, of course, to on the recording, when you record with the Dolby filter in, you boost the highs. And then when you play it back, you put your Dolby filter in, and that cuts the highs back to where they were when you made the recording. And the overall effect, of course, is to cut the tape hiss down. Of course, most of the tape hiss and noise on the emulsion on cheap tape is in the high frequencies. So by use of the Dolby filter, you can cut down a lot of the noise. Now, I may be teaching my old grandmother to suck eggs here, because she may be much more familiar with the electronics of this than I am. I don't know how familiar you are with electronics. But what it amounts to is that if you play the tape without the Dolby filter, it will be a bit scratchy. The high frequencies will be boosted. Now, it will be quite listenable. It'll be quite intelligible, but it will be scratchy. But if you can play it on a machine with a Dolby filter, it will go back to normal. The speech will go back to normal, and all the background, or good 80% of the background noise, will vanish. So if you've got a piece of equipment there with a Dolby filter on it, replay this tape with the Dolby filter in. But if you haven't, doesn't matter, press on. The recording will sound better recorded on a... When you've got a tape, this is a general principle, by the way, which you may not be familiar with, that if you've got a piece of noisy emulsion, which has got a fair bit of background noise in it, and the background noise in the emulsion itself, that you get a better recording if you record with a Dolby filter in than you do, and then play it back without the Dolby filter, in other words, with the highs boosted. You get a better recording listening to it with boosted highs than you do with unboosted highs, because the boosted because the highs, when they're boosted, do tend to cut into the background noise and make the speech more intelligible. I hope this makes sense to you. So I'm recording it on. It's a general principle when I'm working with cheap tape, cheap back or noise. Any sometimes you can pay a lot of money for a bit of tape and find that it's very noisy. But when you're doing recording on tape with a fair bit of background noise, it's best to record, if you've got a Dolby filter on your equipment, to put your Dolby filter in one recording, because it always makes it clearer on playback. This is only true of speech, of course. Music is ruined with a Dolby filter unless you can return it back to normal, because all the highs are boosted and it shrieks at you. But speech, that is true for speech, I've just said. Okay, so much for that. Okay, now to proceed with reply in detail on the tape that you sent me. First off, I would it's a pity that I never will be able to meet Bill Robertson, because he's now deceased. I would have liked to have met the gentleman, because people who do research in this field are very few and far between. Very, very thin on the ground, as they say, are people who do research into the human psyche and the human spirit. I've only got to look into the field of psychiatry to see how few and far between researchers are in the field of the human psyche, because the techniques of psychiatry are very, 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 very little different today than they were 20 years ago. And there hasn't been any great development there in the field of psychiatry, indicating that there's not many people active doing psychiatric research. Oh, there's no doubt lots and lots of psychiatrists spending lots and lots of funds in universities and so forth, getting absolutely nowhere, but they're not doing anything useful, coming up with any practical breakthroughs in their subject, in their field. That's which is exactly why that the material today in psychiatry is much the same as it was 20 years ago. No doubt the rarest of all researchers into the human psyche are those who do research into their own psyche. That is very rare indeed. For every 10 that do research into other people's psyche, there's only about one who does research into their own psyche. And which is why I would like to admit Bill Robertson. Was he very old when he died? Was he an old person, or did he die somewhat unexpectedly? You mentioned on your tape that you've got a stack of data there about a foot high, a paper about a foot high, so he must have been his research must have been very, very productive while he was active. Get a stack of paper a foot high. I was interested in your preliminary remarks on the subject of knots, because I'm familiar with the knots procedure. I was also familiar with the fact that the procedure tends to go on forever, having known a person who was working on knots, and he seemed to be getting absolutely nowhere very, very fast. I don't know whether he's still working on it or whether he's given it away. One should always be very, very, very suspicious of a technique which where material seems to vanish and then comes back into the mind again. In other words, you get rid of something and then something else takes its place, and you get rid of that and something else takes its place. This goes on forever and ever. And one should be very, very suspicious of such a technique, or there's something very, very fundamentally in error when this occurs. The error is usually that you're simply on the wrong track, that what you think is going on is not what's going on, there's something entirely different going on. And I used to think of this when I used to talk to this guy who was doing these knots, and we used to talk about it and the procedure. And I've tried this procedure, this knots. It just didn't mean a thing to me. I worked really hard at it. It just didn't mean anything. I could mock up these entities, and I could move them around and make them put funny hats on them. I could do anything with them. And but I one thing I couldn't get the things to do, and that is do what they were supposed to do according to the textbook. You know, I used to try really hard. I used to mock them up, and I used to misown them. I'd say somebody else is mocking them up. And I'd put them here and I'd put them there, and I'd get other people to move them around. I'd create abundances of them. I'd create scarcities of them. I'd do everything to them, but nothing used to happen. The E-meter just used to sit there, tone arm at 3 with a floating needle, and the whole thing just used to yawn at me. And after a few weeks of fiddling about with this, but I finally said to myself, well, this goddamn procedure's flat on you, Dennis Stevens. You're just wasting time. And then the needle really freed up then and started to float nicely. So obviously that was the correct thing. The process was flat on me. My own research, in other words, my own work I'd done, my own level 5 technology, had flattened the process, if the process ever needed flattening. And it was flat on me when I started it. So I have nothing to report on the subject of knots, except that it was flat on me when I attempted it. I just couldn't get any of the phenomena that other people reported, or any of the phenomena that this guy reported, because he used to explain some of the phenomena he was getting to me. And I certainly got nothing of the phenomena that he was getting. Right, well, so much for the preliminary remarks, Greg. Now to get down to the meat, as they say. What I'm going to say is possibly a little bit revolutionary, but I'm going to have to say it because it's very, very real to me, and it's the way I see the procedure. One has to be very, very careful indeed before one comes across a phenomenon in the human psyche. One has to get very, very, very careful indeed before one determines that this phenomena is being created by any other entity than the preclear. Even though the preclear will swear over a stack of Bibles that this thing in his mind has nothing to do with him, one has to be very, very careful indeed to agree with him on this subject. I myself, in all the research I've ever done, and I can assure you, Greg, that I've ransacked this psyche of mine. I'm also very, very capable of exteriorization. I mean, if I want to tune up my theta perceptics, one of the old procedures I do is I do a little bit of opening procedure by duplication between two meshed objects in present time. That's a sort of a limbering up exercise for me, that is. So I'm no slouch on the subject of OT work. But I can assure you, in all the OT work I've ever come across and worked on and so forth, I've never come across anything in my psyche that is anything but my own creation. My own mock-ups. I never come across any entities. Don't come across them. I've never come across them. Now that might come as a startling to you. Never have. In all of my research, nowhere in the levels of my own technology, nowhere in the lower levels of my own tech, nowhere in the upper levels of my own tech, nowhere in all the material of Dianetics back in 1950 that I ran, the hours and hours of Scientology techniques that were run on me, and various other techniques, and later running solo, the clearing technology, the clearing tech, none of it did ever have I found any entities in my psyche. Now that's interesting, isn't it? So one has to be very, very careful when one comes across something in one psyche which you believe is some entity in present time that's influencing you in present time. Now, I'm not just saying this because I've never found any, because I can assure you that the insane asylums all over the world are full of people who will swear on a stack of Bibles that they've got things in their minds which are alien to them. that they swear that their mind is haunted by beings who are influencing them. The insane asylums are full of these people, and it's one of the first things a person dealing with the mentally disturbed, insane or mentally disturbed, he has to become familiar with this phenomena. I mean, you can walk up to any psychiatrist and talk about entities in your mind and he will just yawn at you. He's heard it all before. He has it every day, 5 days a week in working days, and when he gets called out on the weekend, he's called out to people who've got entities in their minds. And they're all as nutty as bloody fruitcakes, every goddamn one of them. Not one of them turn out to be anything else but misowned circuitry in the bank. So I say this advisedly, Greg. Whoever, put it this way, there's really two types of people in this universe, and two types of beings. There's those who swear that their mind is haunted by entities at the drop of a hat. You know, they'll just swear at the drop of a hat that their mind is haunted by entities. And those who've never seen an entity ever. There's two types. There's definitely two types of people. And I'm one of those who've never seen one. There aren't any, as far as I'm concerned. And there's those who swear that their mind is haunted with entities. The idea that the concept of the entity in the mind as a thetan, as a degraded thetan or an OT thetan, which is a separate thetan from self, which is influencing self, is a peculiarity of a certain section of humanity there. Now, quite clearly, whoever did this research and developed this technique of knots is one of the types of people who believes in the haunted mind theory and who has entities. And he no doubt was grabbed upon this idea of entities and developed this idea of knots. The technique simply couldn't have been developed by a person like me, because I've got no reality on the concept, you see, of entities. And so that's the last thing I would develop is a technique on the subject of entities, simply because as far as I'm concerned, they don't exist. I've never had any reality of them. Now, this phenomena of the haunted mind, which I choose to call the haunted mind theory, is known in psychiatry. They have a technical word for it in psychiatry, and it's as good a word as any. The word they use, they call it dissociation. Dissociation. D-I-S-S-O-C-I-A-T-I-O-N. Dissociation. Not to be confused with disassociation. To disassociate means the sort of to disassociate means to not associate with someone, but dissociation means in psychiatry it has a very precise definition, and it's a very good definition in psychiatry, is the shutting off of one part of the mind by the main part of the mind, and classifying this shut off part of the mind as the class of not self. In other words, the person simply compartmentalizes their psyche into the class of self and not self. There's the bit that they're inhabiting, which they call self, and there's the bit over there, which they're now opposed to, which they call not self. And this becomes the haunted mind. And the person will swear over a stack of Bibles that that bit over that way is not them, even though fundamentally they are mocking it up and making it go through all the motions that it's going through. Now this of course is a classic misownership situation. Here they are mocking something up, putting it on automatic, having it go through various motions, and they're endowing this entity with life with one hand, and with the other hand denying that they're doing it. Now, is it any wonder that when they get into this area, these entities, that their tone arm goes up high and their needle sticks? Now, is it any wonder that happened? with such a classic vision of misownership, one would have thought that some Scientologist down the line, on faced with a pre-clear, or clear as they say, working with knots, who was plagued with a high tone arm, first of all plagued with an endless process that never flattened, and his tone arm had gone up high and his needle had stuck. But surely the guy's tech would have come in and he said to himself, good God, what the hell is going on here? Have we got a classic misownership? There's something wrong here somewhere. This tone arm shouldn't be this high and this needle shouldn't be this sticky with this preclear, with this person. You see that? But no, they all blithely go ahead with the haunted mind theory. They don't apply their own tech to the subject. There's obviously something very odd going on. And a person deals with it, starts dealing with these entities and ends up with a high tone arm and a stuck needle. This is a serious needle. This is a serious case manifestation. It's a serious manifestation, that is, a high tone arm and a stuck needle. It means there's something seriously wrong in the session. I mean, only a complete idiot will try and audit through a high tone arm and a stuck needle. You know, when I used to train auditors in HASI, you know, this was one of the things that I used to dig into them. I used to stand and beat it over their heads, I did the students. You get a high tone arm and a stuck needle, you better do something about it. You just don't blithely press on with a high tone arm and a stuck needle. There's something seriously wrong in the session. You better find out what it is. Could be the guy's got a present time problem. He's got a nail in his shoe that's hurting him. We don't know what it is, but it's giving him a high tone arm and a stuck needle. You better do something about it. Okay, so much for that. Another name for the haunted mind theory is the theory of the hidden influence. Now, some people do honestly believe that their mind can be influenced by entities of which they know not what of. In other words, they believe that their behaviour can be influenced and they have no way of ever finding out who the influencer is, who is doing the influencing. And they genuinely believe this. Well, of course, this is a lot of bullshit. This is a complete violation of communication theory. The truth of the matter is that if anything is influencing your mind, if anything is capable of influencing your mind or influencing you as a personality, then you are quite capable of communicating with this entity and finding out who it is and what it is and finding out all about it. You'll find a note to that effect in my research there. In other words, there aren't any such things as hidden influences. The whole thing is a complete lie. It's a lie to scare the kiddies, you know. It just doesn't, there's no such thing. If you believe that there's such things as hidden influences, you end up with a haunted mind. The truth of the matter is that you can only be influenced by those things that you're capable of discovering. If it can influence you, then you can discover it. You see that? It's just two-way communication. If someone can communicate with you, then you can communicate with them. The fact that they can communicate with you means that you can communicate with them. If somebody can touch you, you can feel the touch. You see that? It's the way it goes. It's two-way communication in the universe. If somebody's going to influence you and move you around and cause you to do things, then you're quite capable of being aware of that this is happening. So there's no such thing as the hidden influence. One of these delightful little fictions that somebody dreamed up to scare the kiddies. But I can assure you, Greg, that there's a large percentage of the inmates of our insane asylums who will again swear over a stack of Bibles that such things as hidden influences do actually exist. They know that they exist. That's why they're in the insane asylum. By the way, reverting back to the high tone arm and stuck needle for a moment, you mentioned on your tape that the current fad, or one of the recent current fads on the subject of high tone arm and stuck needle in HASI, is to blame it on overrun. Well, certainly overrun can produce a high tone arm and a stuck needle. There's no doubt about that. But to say that that's the only cause of it is simply untrue. There's many, many causes of a high tone arm and a stuck needle. Many, 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 many phenomena can bring this about in the human psyche. And overrun is only one of the causes. Now, without more ado, let's get into the anatomy of dissociation. I mean, I've been talking about dissociation so far. Well, can we do anything about it? Is the phenomenon solvable? Oh, yes, indeed. It has a definite anatomy, which I'm very familiar with, and it has a very easy solution. The subject of dissociation, the subject of entities. First of all, the anatomy of dissociation, the essence. Well, first of all, before I go into the anatomy of dissociation, I think I better give some of the more common manifestations of dissociation. I think unless you're aware of this, Greg, you may be surprised at the ramifications, how broad the subject of dissociation is. The most simple manifestation of dissociation is, of course, the old Dianetic circuit, where the person has a command there in the mind which commands him to do things. He may be, say, a bouncer that bounces him up and down his time track. That's a circuit. A little bit of a little postulate sort of shut off from him, which is commanding him there, and which he's quite aware of, but he's powerless to do anything else but obey it. That's probably the most simplest manifestation of dissociation, is the circuit, which Ron covered very, very well in Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health. He spoke very well on the subject of the circuit. He covered the phenomena very well. He obviously researched it very thoroughly, the subject of the circuit. By the way, this whole subject of dissociation was skirted by Ron in his research. He nibbled at the corners of it, but he never came to grips with it head on. Ron didn't. He never came to grips with it. The reason he never came to grips with it head on, this is only a personal opinion, there, I believe that he himself suffered with dissociation. He was a dissociative personality. And was very, very, as I tell you more about the subject, you'll see why I believe this. More about the subject of dissociation, you'll see why I believe that Ron was suffered with it. So, of course, he was inhibited in his research of the subject because of the fact that he was personally involved in it, that he was a dissociative personality himself. So he couldn't really come to grips with it objectively. And he never did in the whole research of Scientology. He nibbled at the corners of it, but he never got right down to grips with it. But anyway, let's press on. The next level of the next more severe level of dissociation would be a person under a compulsion to do something, or a compulsive behaviour, where a person is very, very aware of being compelled to do a thing. It may be when they go out walking, they mustn't walk on the cracks between the paving stones, and they feel compelled to avoid the cracks between on the paving stones. They mustn't put their foot on the crack. They must put their foot between the cracks. It's a compulsion there, and that's dissociation. Or it may be a compulsion to do any behaviour, or that compulsive behaviour is a manifestation of dissociation. It's not a severe manifestation. There's much more severe ones than that, but it is essentially, there's a part of the mind which is split off, which is now commanding the main psyche to do something, and the main psyche is obeying it, and the person is powerless to not obey the commands. Now, the next level of severity, we leave the normal types of neurotic, ordinary behaviour, ordinary type of person. We are now moving into what are classified in psychiatry as the psychoses, and probably the most least severe of these would be the multiple personality personality, where the person manifests one personality for a spell, and then that personality disappears, and they become an entirely different person. If you've ever read the book The Three Faces of Eve, it's well documented in psychiatry. It's not a common condition, but when it does occur, it's quite startling. But it's a manifestation of dissociation, and the psychiatrist or the therapist's job is to marry up all these entities and get them back to one bit again. You've got a split personality, you've got a shattered personality, you've got to put the bits back together. When you've got all the bits back together, you get one personality back again, and all the rest have gone. And but it's a manifestation of dissociation. Now, more severe than the split personality is the... by the way, long before, before we get into the psychiatric pains, I've missed one out. Yes, somewhere between the circuit, the level of the circuit, and the person who is under a compulsion, compulsive behaviour, between the circuit and the compulsive behaviour, would be these entities in the mind which you come across on the subject of knots. You know, they're simply little circuits, that's all. And they don't indicate the person's insane or anything. They just, they're just little split-off circuits. They're just down there at the same level of circuitry. So it's not a serious phenomenon at all. It's quite mild, just mild dissociation. It's the same level of circuitry between circuitry and the person who is under a mental compulsion. It's certainly not as severe as a mental compulsion. It's certainly not anywhere near as severe as a multiple personality. Anyway, above multiple personality, more severe than a multiple personality, of course, is the schizophrenia, where the person has voices and compulsions to act and do things. He's told to do things by voices that talk to him and so forth. And whole sections of his mind are shut off, and he's done a compulsive behaviour, and so on. All the manifestations of schizophrenia, which one can read about in any textbook of psychiatry. This is a severe manifestation of dissociation, dissociated personality. Equally severe is paranoia. The paranoid, he believes that the world is against him. He believes it's a psychotic condition. He believes that people are plotting there. There's entities out there that are plotting, and he unreasonably believes that he's being influenced by these entities. And they're all out to get him. They're all out to destroy him. And this is the paranoid. And schizophrenia and paranoia go together. Do you get the classification of the paranoid schizophrenic? The two go together. Sometimes they're separate, sometimes they're together. Now, the reason why I believe that Ron Hubbard was never able to complete his research, never did fully come to grips with this subject of dissociation in Scientology, is because I happen to know from personal experience of Ron that he was markedly paranoid. He was definitely a paranoid personality, was Mr. Hubbard. It was quite obvious when talking to him. I used to go out and have dinner with the guy, and we used to sit and burn the midnight oil and so forth and chat and drink together. And it was quite, the way he used to talk, it was quite obvious that he felt that he was being got at. He used to genuinely believe that the psychiatrists were ruining Scientology, and I used to argue with him. I say, ridiculous, Ron. Just leave them alone. They're not doing us any harm. We leave them alone, they'll leave us alone. No, Dennis, he used to say, no, there's all sorts of things happening, he'd say. There's funny things going on in on our con lines, and it's the damn psychiatrists. They're out to get us, and we've got to get them first. And I used to say, after a while, I began to realise that this guy was paranoid. I was dealing with a paranoid personality. He wasn't marked. I mean, he wasn't insane, but he was a paranoid personality. He was Ron Hubbard. He always showed many, many occasions in Scientology. He showed many, many paranoid. I'm not the first person the only person to have known that Ron Hubbard had marked paranoid tendencies. So it would be no surprise to me that a man with that degree of paranoia would have difficulty in researching this subject of disassociation, because he himself would disassociate quite badly and would tend to have bits of his own psyche shut off there and acting in quite independently of him, and he would be unable to determine whether they were genuine bits of his personality or whether they were other thetans in present time dictating to him. He'd be unable to determine this because of his own paranoid tendencies. So that's the that's why I believe he never was able to complete this research and thoroughly research this subject of dissociation. He should have done. So considering the importance of the subject, that he never did come to grips with it. there's another areas of the mind, while I'm on this subject, of areas of the psyche that Ron Hubbard never came to grips with. Ron Hubbard never came to grips with the subject of sexuality either. You look through, you hunt through the textbooks of Dianetics and Scientology, and apart from the good old prenatal coitus engrams of book one, and a bit on blanketing in the history of man, you will hunt in vain for anything on the subject of sex in the textbooks of Scientology. Or in his lectures come to that. Ron was very, very quiet on the subject of sex. Well, when you consider how important sex is in the subject of human beings' lives, you would think that it would have a far greater mention in the subject of Scientology than it actually had. And so we can probably assume, and I happen to know for a fact, that he did have lots and lots of troubles on the subject of sex, did Ron? And he was quite unable to do any research on that subject. Anyway, that's a digression. But that gives you some idea, going back to those manifestations of dissociative personality. It's quite broad, isn't it? It goes from a simple circuit through compulsive, through the phenomena you see in knots, through compulsive behaviour into the realms of psychosis. In fact, apart from various degenerative conditions of the mind to do with old age or alcoholism or poisoning and so forth, dissociation is the common denominator of most insanities. The vast majority of people in insane asylums or who are classified as insane are dissociative personalities. The only other types of personalities that are classified as insane is the dementias from aged people, dementias or alcoholic dementia from poisons, so forth. And that pretty well wraps it up. There isn't any other psychosis. So you can see how important the subject of dissociation is, and how strange it is that it was never researched by Ron Hubbard. It's never fully researched. It's quite interesting. When you start to study the subject of dissociation, you see realize that this whole thing is a great big hole in Scientology called, where's dissociation? Ron never mentioned it. Never mentioned the whole subject of dissociation. Interesting. In case you think I'm maligning Mr. Hubbard, I'm not. I still think that he's one of the greatest psychotherapists of this century. In fact, he may have been the greatest of his contributions to human knowledge of the mind. His contribution is second to none. But the man was a genius in his field. But that still doesn't get away from the fact that he was markedly paranoid and was a dissociative personality and had lots and lots of troubles on the subject of sex. That's the truth of the matter. Well, I see this tape is running towards the end. I'll just stop it and have a look at it. No, it's not running towards the end. It's my eyesight that's running towards the end. I'll just take it out and had a close look at it. There's a good 3 or 4 minutes left on this, so I won't go over. I'll probably run off the end of the spool. So let's now go into the subject of solving the solution to the subject of dissociation. Now, the subject of this dissociation, the basis of it is this: our old friend, the subject of problems and solutions. A person has a problem. This is the way it works out. The person, usually in childhood, has a problem, and they solve the problem, and the solution works. that's the key point. The solution works. So every time they get this problem, they put this solution into action, and the solution keeps working. And the solution eventually, this is the key point. This is the solution becomes an automatic solution. And every time the problem turns up, the solution goes in, and the thing becomes more automatic. Eventually, they create a little entity. The child will create a little entity in his mind there, which puts the solution in as soon as the problem comes in. We all do it. And then the problem come along, and automatically he will put the solution into effect there. Now, the intensity, the degree to which he puts the automaticity in varies from person to person. Although we all do this, some go completely overboard on it and create a fully fledged entity, complete with a purple hat or what have you, and create an identity that goes with the purpose, with the function, and the whole thing is sort of mocked up there. This is the dissociative personality. And another person, a person like me, simply created it as a little machine, as a little servo mechanism. But it never really was granted much life, and so it never did build into it, get itself into anything special. It was just a little servo mechanism that would put the postulate into action when the problem turned up. It would put the solution into action, you see. So although we all do it to varying degrees, and the dissociative type of personality does it to a marked degree, and the type of personality who doesn't dissociate in later life only does it to a very, very minor degree. So that's the essence of it there, Greg, is the fixed solution which goes into action. Then one day, inevitably, what happens is that one day the fixed solution goes into action, and horror of horrors, it doesn't solve the problem. And this is awful. See, always up to now the solution has worked, and suddenly it stopped working. Why would the solution no longer work? Well, of course, it could be any number of reasons. Times change, different circumstances. Nothing stays the same for very long in this universe, as we all know. So his fixed solution, one day, inevitably, his fixed solution is no longer going to work. We know it for absolute certainty. And I know for absolute certainty that I'm getting to the end of this spool. So I'm going to switch it over. So I'll see you on the other side of the spool, Greg. Just run it onto the end, and I'll start right close in at the other side. So just run the spool to the end. Well, here we are back again on side two, Greg. Same date. You might have noticed that about halfway through the first side of this tape, that the background music stopped. I switched it off. I switched it off because there's no need for it anymore. The external noises stopped, ceased to distract me, so I switched off the background music because it was no longer necessary. Now quiet outside. Moving on with the subject of problems and solutions, yes, we have the fixed solution, and then one day he finds it doesn't work, it no longer works. It's inevitably that can happen to it. It's the inevitable end point of all fixed solutions, is that one day they don't work. And then, of course, he tries to stop the solution from going into action. And then the fun starts. He can't stop it. He can't stop the machine from working. He set it up to act automatically, you see. And he can no longer, he's lost control of the machine. Now, this is where he does a very, very stupid thing. Very, very stupid thing. He opposes the machine. He now opposes the thing. And he says, this is now a compulsive behaviour I've got now. I don't want to do this anymore, but I find myself doing it. Every time X happens, I do Y. And I don't want to do Y every time X happens. And I must stop myself from doing Y every time X happens. See, he opposes his fixed solution. Now that is this is where the trouble starts. Up to now, everything's all right, no problem at all. The correct thing he should have done at this instant was to create lots and lots of machines and put them over that way that were doing things for him. In other words, he should have duplicated his exact sequence up to that point of creating the automaticity to put in the solution automatically. He should have consciously done what the machine was doing for him automatically. In other words, he should have duplicated the machine. Now, Ron had this technology. He knew this very thoroughly. And I learnt that from the old man back in the 1950s. He got that bit out all right. He knew about the automaticity and the fixed solution and so forth. And so there's nothing new about what I'm telling you up to now. It's standard Scientology tech, unless they've gone and lost it. They've flipping well gone and lost it. I don't know what they're doing down there these days. They might have lost it. But anyway, Ron had that tech. He understood that. But he didn't talk about it in terms of dissociation. He talked about it in terms of problems and solutions. He didn't relate it to the subject of dissociation like I'm doing. So anyway, the person makes this mistake. He now opposes the fixed solution. Of course, he can't stop the machine from working. So now he puts it over that way and goes in, raises his flag and goes into a great games condition with his own fixed solution. Now, again, some personalities do this much more than others. Some do it very, very little. Some seem to sense it's a stupid thing to do, to go into opposition to their own machinery, and they simply don't do it. They somehow skirt round it and unmock the machine. They don't do it. I never did it. I ransacked back through my childhood. This mechanism I've never done. I can't find myself ever having done it. I used to set the machines up, but I always knew that it was me doing it. I never took my finger off the machine, even though the machine was running automatically. I could always leave my finger on the machine and always stop the machine. See, I never took my finger right off it. Maybe that was the secret of my success. I never took my finger off the machine. But some people take their finger right off the machine and put it in the class of not-self. Then when the machine, they want to stop the machine, they can't stop the machine, because now the machine is over that way and it's out of their control by their own postulate. It's not that the machine runs out of control by any other postulate but theirs. I mean, as soon as you put a thing into the class of not-self, you're now saying that it's no longer going to obey your postulates. That's what you mean when you put a thing in the class of not-self. It's no longer going to obey your postulates. It's now acting under other determinism. It's now acting under somebody else's postulate. So you've got nobody to blame but yourself if you set up a machine, put it in the class of not-self, and then wonder why you can't control it anymore. It's only obeying. The machine never do anything else but obey your own postulates. So you can't blame anyone but yourself for being damn stupid. Anyway, some people do it, and they get caught on this mechanism. And this will be the dissociative type of personality. And so they end up with this machine over that way that they're now opposed to. They've now got a split-off part of their psyche, this automatic machine over that way, and the next thing you know, they've got an entity there, and or a cluster of entities, all on an associated subject. As you know from knots, that the entities tend to cluster in similarity of subject. They associate in the mind under similarity of postulate, similarity of subject matter, and that's no great surprise to anyone that this should happen, because that's the way the mind gets built. But nevertheless, this is the anatomy of the dissociation, Greg. This is how it comes about. And now, what is required to be done about it in therapy? Well, in my own therapy, nothing. It simply comes out in the wash at level 5A. By the time the person's done level 5A, and just to remind you what level 5A consists of, the person is putting up postulates, they're creating postulates themselves, and they're then putting up postulates in the class of not-self, created by others. They're mocking up others, creating postulates in the class of not-self. Then they're creating postulates in the class of self. They're working all the time with this class of self and not-self, on very, very powerful postulates at level 5A. Well, after they've been doing this for 10 or 20 hours, all their automatic machinery is shot to pieces. They just tear it apart. Because, you see, they're now an expert at creating things in the class of not-self. It's as easy for them to create things in the class of not-self as it is to create things in the class of self. It doesn't make any difference to them. I mean, I can mock up things in the class of not-self just as easily as I can create them in the class of self. I can mock up other people mocking things up just as easily as I can mock things up myself. I know what which is which. I keep them quite separate. But one's just as easy for me to do as the other. No great difficulty in it. Most people, unless they've worked on this subject, you're asking them to mock something up, they mock it up in the class of self. It never occurs to them to mock it up in the class of not self, unless you ask them to do so. And then some people have a lot of difficulty doing it. They can't mock things up in the class of not self. They say, oh no, I can't do that. Well, all that comes out in the wash at level 5A in my tech. They get over that. By the time they finish level 5A, they've just broken all this machinery down. All the enters have gone. So my solution to the problem of disassociation is level 5A. And it's not a specific address to it. It simply comes out in the wash at level 5A, because it's covered in level 5A. When you've done level 5A, you've broken all the entities down. They've all gone, because they're only just postulates in the class of not self. You see, look, Rick. Let's understand what is an identity? Let's understand what an identity is and how an identity comes about in the mind. An identity is simply a collection of postulates. Now, the postulates come before the identity. This is a very, very important datum. It's not that you create an identity and then the identity starts operating on certain postulates. That isn't the way it works. It works the other way around. You get the postulates. First there's the postulates. The postulates go into action. And then we say, well, a person who uses those postulates is a blank. See that? And we will call this person is now the identity of a blank. You know, a fisherman is a man who fishes. His postulate is to fish. You see that? But first, how did a fisherman, the identity of a fisherman, ever come about? Well, one day somebody started fishing, you see. And then somebody else started fishing. And they started fishing. And then they say, well, we need an identity for this. Who is the person who's doing the fishing? Well, a fisherman. He's now a fisherman. So they invented the word fisherman. And the word is a concept of an identity there. And now we have the identity of a fisherman. But the identity of the fisherman comes later than the postulate to fish. See that? And it stems from the postulate to fish. So the entity in the mind, you come across an entity in the mind, your tendency is to say, well, now I must try and get rid of this entity. Flunk. It's the wrong way to go about it. The correct way to take an entity apart in the mind is to find out what postulates it's operating on. It's just to find out its postulates. And one by one, take over control of those postulates. Create them yourself. I mean, it could be creative processing. It could be as crude as that. Or it could be something as sophisticated as my level 5A. But it amounts to the same thing. That you're going to get in there and create these postulates and take over the creation of these postulates. Then the entity collapses. See, once you've got rid of the postulates, you stop creating the postulates that the entity is based upon, the entity vanishes. Because the entity is only, it consists of the postulates. It doesn't consist of anything else but the postulates. A fisherman, the entity of a fisherman, the valence identity of a fisherman, doesn't consist of anything else but the postulate to fish. Plus the postulate to be human, we might say. But that's common to all human identities, the postulate to be human. The thing that differentiates out the fisherman is the postulate to fish. You see that? And once you've erased the postulate to fish out of the mind, the fisherman's gone. And that's the easiest way to erase a fisherman from the mind is to erase the postulate to fish. The hard way to go about it is to try and erase the fisherman without touching the postulate to fish. That is the hard way to go about it. You might get there, you might get lucky, but it's the hard way to go about it. The correct way to go about it is to address the postulate. Then the identity, the entity, call it what you will, vanishes. That's why in my therapy I only work with postulates. I don't work with identities. I don't work with entities. I don't have to. But work with postulates. The entities, identities come out in the wash. They all do. I knew that. One of my research data. The identities consist of postulates. That's all they consist of. So you only have to work with the postulates in the class of self and in the class of not self. And all the identities and violences and so forth come out in the wash. And they do. They fly off at level 5A. They fly off in all directions, quite violently. So they all come apart. So that's the way I would do it in my therapy. Now, there's other ways you could do it. There's lots of ways you could skin this particular cat called disassociation. You could treat the thing purely as a problem in problems and solutions and back up Scientology tech. You could get the person to mock up a machine that creates entities, mock up a machine that creates these postulates, mock up a machine that creates postulates that become entities. Then mock up lots of machines. Now become the machine. Then have other people mocking up the machines. You can put creative processing. You can go taking back into childhood. Pick up the points when he created the solution to the problem. Pick up, date it, find the moments in time when he first came across this postulate and set the machinery up. You do it that way. That might be a hard way to do it, by the way, but you could do it that way. It could be done Dianetically. But the fastest way to do it would be my tech in level 5A. I swear it, it's the fastest way to do it. But it's not the only way to do it. There's lots and lots of ways you can do it if you understand the mechanism involved, the mechanism of the entity, the mechanism of the identity. Basically, it's a problem. It's the old problems and solution technology. Just in passing, when you mentioned on your tape, at the beginning of your tape, you were talking about knots and the phenomena they came across, knots. I had to play this back over. I thought this was most peculiar. But no, it was the way you said it. And it was quite true. I quite believe it. That you said that when they were starting to put intentions, they start to come up scale and OTs and start to put intentions out into the environment, they started to get somatics. And in auditing, you know, or what have you, they started, as soon as they started to put their intentions out in the environment, they started to get somatics. So then they sat down and tried to figure out a technique to handle the somatics. Flunk, breach of the auditor's code. If you had a pre-clear walking around, you're running HC on a pre-clear, you're walking around the room, and you're touching, getting him to touch objects in the room, and he turns on somatics. Now, what does the auditor's code tell you to do? It doesn't tell you to sit down and try and figure out a process to handle the somatic, does it? The auditor's code is very precise on this subject. It says that you continue the process as long as it's producing change, and then you stop doing the process. Auditor's code. So you're walking a free clear around the room touching objects, he turns on somatics, you go on with the process. You know, to do anything else is a flunk, it's a code breach. It's just, you know, it's one of the things that separates the auditors from the non-auditors. The auditors go on with the process as long as it's producing change, while non-auditors don't do that. It separates the auditors out from the psychiatrists, this one does. The auditors go on, flatten the process, and the psychiatrists quit. But hey, we get onto the subject of upper level tech, and the person is now out in the environment putting postulates into the environment. They start to turn on somatics. The correct solution to that problem is to go on putting postulates in the environment and flatten the process. See that? There never was any need to invent the knots, you see. It always was an unnecessary solution. All they had to do was flatten the goddamn process. If this OT is getting somatics every time he puts postulates out in the environment, fine. Start a session. Auditing command. Place some postulates into the environment. Thank you. You're getting a somatic. Thank you very much. We're going to continue this process. Here's the next command. Put some more intentions into the environment. Oh, your somatics are getting worse. Okay, we're going to continue this process. You know, just ordinary, routine auditing. Don't have to be a level 14 auditor to handle that sort of situation. You know, a level 1 auditor can handle that. Continue the process as long as it's producing change. This is what startled me. I could hardly believe that somebody of the technical expertise of a David Mayo would fall so easily into such a simple trap of not flattening a process and coming along and inventing an unusual solution. So it's a bit peculiar, isn't it? Somebody around here is a bit obsessed with the subject of entities. Now, the odd thing is that if you was to take a person, a newly fledged OT, and he starts putting intentions, purposes into the environment, and he turns on a somatic, if you was to go on with the process, eventually it would turn off. Eventually the somatics would turn off. He may discover, however, and I have come across this phenomena, he may discover that the cause of his somatics is that in putting the postulates into the environment, he's creating efforts in his own body, and these efforts go into counter efforts in his own body, and the conflict between the effort and counter efforts in his body is causing a somatic. In other words, he himself is generating the somatics in his own body by creating efforts in his own body when he's putting postulates out into the environment. Maybe he's trying to use his body by trying to get the postulates out into the environment by using body effort. Some people do this. They're stuck in effort, and they try and project mentally using the effort band, and then the end point of that is that they're going to get somatics in their body. They could be there, but all this would come out in the wash if you simply continued the process of putting intentions into the environment. Eventually the pericle would ignite. If he was doing this, he'd eventually ignite as where he was getting all these somatics from. He'd say, oh, I'm putting all this effort in my body. That's where the pain's coming from. In other words, it's nothing to do with his track. It's simply a present time phenomena. So that phenomena could occur. But anyway, that would come out in the wash. That was simply just another reason why he's getting the somatics. But the correct procedure would be to flatten the process. So I'm afraid David Mayer has gone down in my estimation. I always had a rather high regard for the chap as a Scientologist, but if he fell for that one, he definitely needed to do a retread, he did, if he fell for that. Probably the most awful thing about the dissociative phenomena is that it's cumulative. A person has one failure. They have their first failure as a child, say, and they get a machine goes out of control, or some bit of their mind goes out of control, and they shut that bit off over that one. They finally get that bit all quietened down, and the next time they get into this, it happens more easily. In other words, it's failure breeds failure, and the next thing they know, they're well into a haunted mind. And this would be, you will get the dissociative type of personality. Now, I can give you more data on the type of personality that is going to become dissociative. The type of postulates that this person will be operating on, I can even give you that. And that's about as far as I can go on the subject and tell you the dissociative type of personality. Do you remember the four basic postulates in my level 5A? To be known, to not be known, to know, and to not know. They're the four basic postulates. They're the ones that I work with at level 5A. And, well now, it should be no surprise to anyone that people tend to fixate into one or the other of these four postulates. They tend to base their modus operandi in life on one or the other of these postulates. Now, let me say at once that the two positive legs of the to know goals package are are the favourites. The most common is to be known. That is the most common of all the postulates that you will find a person dramatising in life. Of that four, the most common you will find them dramatising is to be known. The assertive personality. The person is assertive and often assertive, often quite creative, so forth. And extrovert. All this is in my research notes, by the way. I have no need for me to repeat it. You can find it by reading it up there. These are the characteristics of that personality. The next most common is the to know personality. This person is tends to be introverted, introspective, studious, willing to learn, so on. Now, far less common are the two negative types of personality. First of all, to not know. That's the next most common one. To not know. This person is the rejecting type of personality. He simply doesn't want to know. And the least common of all is to not be known. This type of person is virtually in hiding. The hiding type of personality, the retiring personality. Now, the thing is that when you audit the negatives, you get a person who's in to not know, or is dramatising to not know, or is dramatising to not be known, and you audit them. You take the person who's in to not know. When you audit him, he comes up scale, and he starts to go over more and more towards the to be known postulate. In other words, the cycle of the person in the to be known postulate is that his opposition terminal is to not know. That's the enemy, is to not know, and he takes on the characteristics of it. And the further and further he goes down scale, the more he goes into the violence of to not know. So as you audit him and he's in to not know, as you audit him and bring him up scale, you'll eventually bring him back up to the to be known postulate. So actually the person who's stuck in to not know, when you audit him, he comes up scale, and you find that he's a to be knowner. that's where he really belongs, up there. And similarly, with a person who's stuck in to be not known, he's the opposition terminal of the knower. You see, the knower is opposed to the postulate to be not known, and the knower who's operating the postulate to know, he will eventually become, go into the violence of to not be known. So he goes and eventually goes into hiding. And as you audit him, he comes out of the hiding and goes back into the to know postulate. So really there's only the two, to be known and to know. They're quite distinctive personality types, quite distinctive. The knowers make good scientists and so forth, studious, tend to be academic, thoughtful. So on the be known, extrovert, outgoing, active, great sportsman, so on, you know. I don't need to belabor the point. You see the differences between the two types of personality right away. But of the two types of personality, the type of personality that is more likely to become dissociative is the to be known personality, simply because he's more likely, you see the opposition terminal, he's opposed, the to be known personality is opposed by rejection. He's you can almost tell, by the way. I mean, before I go on, I better explain these little bits to you. You can always pick which postulate goes with the person. You've only got to say to the person, all right, now, what sort of incident has upset you in your life? What type of incident has upset you? You say this to the person, and he says, oh, well, things I don't like in my life. I don't like being rejected. I don't like rejection. Yes, he says, oh, you finally decide that they're the sort of things. He says, I'm really very sensitive to rejection. Well, you don't have to look any further. He's a to be known, but he's operating on the to be known postulate, because the opposition terminal to be known is to not know, which is rejection. He gets rejected, you see. The not knower rejects him. So that's his opposition terminal. So you can always tell. The to know postulate, the person who's dramatising the to know postulate, his opposition terminal is to be not known. So you say to him, now what sort of incidents in your life have upset you most? And he thinks about it for a while. You think, oh, well, he's going to say being rejected. No, he's not particularly worried about rejection, this type of personality. The thing that upsets him is deprivation. He can't stand being deprived of things. He can't stand being prevented from knowing things. You see, his opposition terminal is preventing him from knowing things. It's being prevented from knowing is the thing that gets him. He doesn't like secrets. His opposition terminal is a secretive person, you see. Somebody who's hiding things all the time, depriving him of things. He hates being deprived of things. So he says, well, all my worst things in my life is being deprived of things and being prevented from knowing things. They're the things he detests most, you see. So he tells you that, you know where he is. He's a knower. Now, the person who's stuck in to not know, say to him, what sort of incidents in your life upset you most? And he says, well, I'll tell you that right away. He says, I can't stand people inflicting things on me. I just hate infliction. Infliction's a terrible thing, he'll say. This person's stuck in not know. His op term is a be known. The be known's an inflictor. It's one of the characteristics of the be known, must be known personalities. He goes around and inflicts things on people. And the not knower, he can't stand that. He can't stand having things be inflicted on him. So that's that the instance he doesn't like. He doesn't like having things inflicted on him. And you be not known personality, you say to him, well, now what sort of incidents upset you most in your life? And he thinks about it and says, well, the worst things that happened in my life is being forced to reveal things, is to be found out. They're the very worst things that can happen to him. You see, he's a secretive type of personality. And if others come along, and he's opposed to the knower, so he can't stand people who know, want to know things. He can't stand their curiosity, their inquisitiveness. And the worst thing, all the worst upsets he's had in his life of being forced to reveal things. So his upset is revelation. He's upset by revelation, being forced to reveal things, being forced to be known. Being forced to be known as his upset. So there's your four, you see. So you can tell which postulate of the four the person is dramatising by asking them what sort of incidents upset them most. And it's quite distinctive. You know, there's no doubt, you'll find that when you ask people this, that there's no doubt, you won't get any cross types, that people do fall into one of those types or another. There's no doubt about it. You won't find a person say, oh, well, I don't like being rejected, and I don't like being deprived of things. Oh, no, you won't get that. You won't get crossed up. It's quite distinctive, you know. The person who doesn't like being rejected, he doesn't mind being deprived of things. He don't care for it particularly. It's no great deal with him. And the person who doesn't like being deprived of things, although he doesn't like being rejected, it doesn't really bother him, really. You know, it's not his game. You see how that would be? So it's quite distinctive. Now, the reason why the dissociative personality is more likely to be a be-knowner, you can see immediately why this is. That he's outgoing. He puts up these postulates. He puts up these postulates, these fixed solutions, you see, and then one day he tries to change the fixed solution and he can't. Immediately he feels that he's being got at, that he's being, you know, his own machinery is now rejecting his orders, his commands. And he gets very, very upset about this. And this is why I think is the basic, I can't prove this, but I think that this is why some personalities are dissociative and some aren't. I think it depends upon this basic postulate they're operating on. And I'm sure it's the benown personality is the sucker for dissociation. The no personality is quite immune to it. He's quite immune to it. He's quite immune to dissociation. That I'm a basically, or I used to be, I mean the postulates are so faint with me now, but I used to be, before I did my level 1, level 5A, I used to be a knower. And that used to be my favourite postulate, you see. But, and certainly in my case, I'm not a dissociative personality. I never have been, even when I was a knower. I was dramatising that postulate quite heavily as a young man, that I was not a dissociative personality. Never have been in this lifetime. But there's plenty of evidence to back up what I'm saying, although I can't prove it without doing lots more research on lots and lots of other people, which I probably never will get the chance to do at this stage. But I would lay a bet on it that it's the dissociative personality is fundamentally, his postulate he's operating on is to be known. And I know for a fact that the paranoid type of personality is always, the paranoid personality is always operating on the benign postulate. It's the only postulate he operates on. So when you now that's not to say that every person operating on that postulate is paranoid. No. But if you find a person who's got paranoid tendencies, this person is basically a to be known personality. Hubbard was basically a to be known personality. And he was markedly paranoid. And I've known quite a number of paranoid people in my lifetime, and every one of them showed all the characteristics of the to-be-known personality. They're all extroverts, all outgoing, in their natures, and so on. They showed all the manifestations of the to-be-known personality. So there's quite a lot to be... There's a lot of correlation there between those basic four postulates and life, Greg. They're not just they're not just something I dreamed up. And they just sit there in my research. They're real living things that sit in real living people in the environment. And the more you work with them, the more you come to realize that they are just what I say they are. The four basic postulates. They don't come any more basic than those four. And the person gets those straightened out at level 5A and works with others, gets those out of the way, it kicks great big holes in their bank. Great big holes, great big chunks get kicked out of their bank. Hello, me old buddy. I see that I'm getting towards the end of this tape and I'm going to close off now. It's getting towards 9 o'clock, half past 9, it's 9:15. I'm getting a bit tired. I may, there's a bit more space on this tape, I might fill it. I may not, or I may send it off to you. Anyway, I'll bid you good night for the moment. Ta-ra for now. This is an addendum to the tape made sometime later, and re-listening to the tape, I realised that I forgot to mention other applications of TROM for the resolution of the subject of entities from the mind. Generally speaking, it's not advisable to address the subject of entities in the mind unless they interfere with therapy. So unless they interfere, you wouldn't get involved with the subject. One would simply proceed on through the levels. But if entities did interfere with the running of TROM, they can be addressed right from level 2. There's nothing at all to prevent a person from putting up an entity and finding some differences and similarities between an entity and a present time physical universe object. In other words, simply treat it as a part of the mind. The entity is a part of the psyche and can be treated as such. And if it shows up in therapy, it should be treated as such. So if the entity shows up at level two, interferes with therapy at level two, then it should be addressed at level two. And the entity should be put up, and differences and similarities found between the entity and present time physical universe objects. Similarly, at level 3, if entities interfere at level 3, they can be time broken against present time physical universe objects. For the vast majority of people, the whole phenomena will be gone by the time the person gets to the top of level 3. But nevertheless, if the phenomena does persist, it will, of course, as I mentioned on the lecture, the level 5A will hit at it. It will fall apart at level 5A, and if it doesn't fall apart at level 5A, oh my God, it should have gone by then. You can always, if there's any residual phenomena hanging around, you can simply make the junior universe of entity the subject matter of the to-know goals package at level 5C. And that, so help me, would be the end of it. That would be the end of it. So the subject of entities, to recapitulate, can be addressed at levels 2, levels 3, level 5A, we'll get at it, get at the subject, as I mentioned on the main lecture. And also it can be addressed specifically and finally at level 5A. So there's the little addendum I wanted to make on the subject of entities. But just to repeat again, so you've got the message that you do not address entities unless they interfere with therapy. You just continue on with the therapy unless they interfere. But if they do interfere in the running of TROM, then you address them in the way that I've suggested at these various levels. Thanks very much.